The Oracle Network.
Riddle Me That is a true crime podcast that deals with adult themes. Some episodes explore disturbing topics such as murder, abuse, sexual violence, drug abuse, suicide, and self-harm. Please listen at your own risk. Theories discussed in episodes may not be the opinion of the host.
Hi, just a couple things before we get started on this Lavina Lynn Johnson series. I just want to let everybody know this is going to be very deep with the discussions. We're going to be speaking about Lavina's case, but we're also going to be talking about broader institutional issues, institutions like the military, educational institutions. So if you're looking for a straightforward narrative episode, these won't be it. They're going to be six parts. We're going to go through every little detail of Lavina's case while we discuss those other institutional issues. So I really hope that you enjoy it, but I'm also going to link Margot's episode for military murders in case you want just a straightforward, shorter narrative episode. You could definitely go and check that out. Welcome back to the show. I'm Jules, and this is Riddle Me That, True Crime. So today I'm redoing an episode that screams for justice, and it's really haunted me since I first covered it. I didn't want to simply redo it. I wanted to bring on two really intelligent women to both tell the story with me and discuss the details. So you all know criminologist Dr. Ashley Wellman. She's one of my co-hosts from The Path Went Chilly and frequent collaborator on the show. Welcome back, Ashley. Do you want to tell listeners a bit about your background?
Sure. Thanks for having me, Jules. It's nice to be one of your guests again. I missed you. Well, a little bit about my background. I actually earned my PhD in criminology, law, and society. And my research since 2008 has centered on working alongside families of cold case homicides. So watching the lived experiences and working alongside these families to kind of understand the grief and the complexities that come after a murder goes unsolved, for whether it's 2 years or 50 years, they're just such complex cases.
So Ashley will be learning about this case along with all of you, and she'll be giving her insights throughout the story. So Mel is going to help me tell the story. And Mel is the host of the popular true crime podcast, Mask of Sanity. And Mel is one of the boss bees from the Oracle 3. So do you want to tell the listeners a little bit about what got you into podcasting and starting a network?
I feel like that's a loaded question, Jules. I would love to. And I'm very excited to be here. I love your show. And I love The Path Went Chilly. That's like my new thing right now. I've been doing my podcast. I mean, I'm on a break right now. But I've been doing it since January of 2020. So I had started it before the pandemic, but I'm so glad that I did because that's what kind of got me through 2020. I had just always really liked true crime podcasts. I listened to a ton of them and it just kind of made sense for me to start my own. So I did. And honestly, I didn't really know what I was getting myself into and how much work it is. Because it's a lot. It's not as easy as everybody thinks it is. It's not just setting up a microphone and talking. There's a lot of work that goes into the behind the scenes and just putting out a good quality product. So I'm glad I didn't know that because I don't know if I would have started it. But it's just something I enjoy. It's a creative outlet, especially with the pandemic when everything shut down. I'm an actor too. So all of that kind of went away when everything shut down, and it gave me a creative outlet to have something to work on. And then starting the Oracle Network and working with Melissa, it's been challenging because, again, I didn't really know much about starting a network or how to do that, but we've kind of just figured it out. We have some really awesome shows, including yours, Riddle Me That, on the network. And it gets better and better. The more we figure out, the more shows, the more people get involved, the more people hear about it. So yeah, that's a very long explanation to the question, answer to the question, but yeah.
Yeah, it's a really great group of shows and a really great group of people. So the story we're talking about today, I know, is not only significant to me, but Margot covered it on military murder as well. And I'll be talking to her in a future expert episode. Because she's a JAG officer. Basically, that's a military lawyer, for those of you unfamiliar with the terminology. I don't know. I liked that show JAG when I was a kid. So watch that?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Mel, do you want to give us a quick synopsis?
Sure. I mean, anybody who's familiar with this story knows that it is just completely heartbreaking. It's about a family search for justice. So as I like to say on my show, buckle up, my friends, because we're in for a bumpy ride. In 2004, a young woman graduated from high school in Missouri. And like so many young folks, myself included, she had her heart set on the military. And really, she wanted to go to college. She wanted to go to the University of California, to be exact. But like a lot of us, her family wasn't prepared to fund such an expensive school. And this young lady didn't want to burden anyone with that expense anyway. She felt it was in her heart to join the military and then have the military fund her education. And her recruiter assured her that even though it was the height of the war, she wouldn't deploy. Now, for me personally, being a veteran myself, when I heard this, I couldn't believe my ears. I don't know why or how this recruiter thought that he could make this kind of promise, given the just the deployment ops tempo of the time in the U.S. Army. It doesn't seem feasible, and it seems like a lie to tell a recruit that, because obviously it wasn't true. And as often is the case, a year into her military time at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, she got deployment orders, and off she went to Balad, Iraq. And it was here that this young lady's demeanor would change. She felt that her interactions with male soldiers changed. She felt she was not given the respect she deserved. And in 2005, just a few weeks before she was scheduled to return home, this young woman would be found dead in a contractor's tent that had reportedly not been in use since construction on this particular project on base was stopped. And to anyone with eyes looking in, the scene appeared to have been potentially staged. There were strange inconsistencies. Part of this young woman's genitals and tongue had been removed during the first autopsy, and yet a rape kit had never been performed. And so many began to wonder, was the military covering for someone? Why was there a rush to call this a suicide? This is the story of the highly suspicious death of Lavina Lynn Johnson.
So before we get into the story, I'm just going to list a couple sources that I used while compiling this episode. I used the documentary, A Silent Truth, and it's all about Lavina's case. You can find it on YouTube, and I highly recommend that you check it out. I also watched an SBS Dateline episode titled Dark Secrets. I was fortunate enough to have Margot send me the U.S. Army's report on the death of Lavina. It contains interviews with her friends, sketches of the crime scene, what first responders and those who discovered her body found. This was invaluable as it served to definitely balance my perspective, so I wasn't looking at the case with conclusions already drawn. So I'll link these sources and the rest of the print sources that I used in the show notes.
Private First Class Lavina Lynn Johnson was born on July 27, 1985, to parents Dr. John Johnson and mother Linda Johnson. Dr. John Johnson served in the military and eventually went to school for psychology. And while he did not stay on active duty long, after he earned his PhD, he went on to work for the military as a civilian psychologist with a specialty in preventing soldier suicide, which to me means he was knowledgeable of recognizing the signs of potential self-harm in soldiers. So in theory, he would have been able to recognize this in his daughter if she was, in fact, contemplating suicide. The couple also had 5 children in total, including Lavina. She had her younger sister and 3 older brothers.
So Lavina was a really focused young woman from her young age. She always made honor roll and was not only gifted in academics, but she was also a budding philanthropist. Lavina was so devoted to her animal rights causes that she paid her dues to PETA out of her own allowance. Like, can you believe this? I just love this about her so much. And she also made the choice to become a vegetarian for ethical reasons at the age of 12 and was very concerned about recycling, according to her father, Dr. Johnson.
I find it incredibly interesting that her father specialized in the military, members of the military, and suicide. Mel, you nailed it. As soon as you said that, I'm like, correct. If this was eventually ruled a suicide, this is a man with a PhD who is hired by the military as a civilian to help prevent soldier suicide. So I find it incredibly foreshadowing and overwhelming. For me, I can only imagine what her father would have felt when her death was eventually declared a suicide, right? The guilt, the shame, how did I not know? And then maybe the, wait a minute, this is not what happened, right? This very confident conclusion that, no, that's not what happened here. Okay. Before that, I will try not to get ahead of myself. Jules, you were saying what an awesome kid she was. Let's start with Lavina as a child. I feel like the description of her family is that she had such a solid foundation to start from, that she was a very grounded child, a very well-supported child. Heck, she paid for a PETA membership out of her own allowance. I adore her.
And she was also an advocate for environmental protection. This was a young woman who was not only focused on herself and her family, she cared about those around her and issues that are not typically front and center to young children. So the fact that she did that speaks volumes to the kind of person that she was. She was one of those special kids, the kind that are wise beyond their years. She was brilliant and unique. And I'm going to jump on the bandwagon. I absolutely adore her for all she does. This is incredible.
You know, Ashley, I think she was probably raised in a home that was like, you know, very much, you know, into religion. And, you know, she always had her Bible with her, apparently. And she was very concerned with ethics and all these sorts of things. And she reminds me of like my little sister, who she is no longer religious. But when she was that age, she wanted to become a vegetarian when she was like, I don't know, like 7 or 8 or something. And she used to wear this cross necklace, and nobody else on my dad's side of the family was religious, but my little sister would like go around, you know, talking about God and like being this little vegetarian. So I can't help but think about that when I think about Lavina. And I just think she sounds like such an amazing, like you said, Ashley, well-supported little human being.
And what's crazy is this is a time when kids are little, right? Everything really is about their little world. It's about themselves. It's about the next thing I get to do. It's about immediate gratification, television, fashion, toys. And then you have this little one who's so focused on global issues. It's astonishing.
So Lavina admired her father, Dr. Johnson. She closely watched him as he worked for the military as a civilian psychologist. Lavina knew that college was going to be expensive, as Mel mentioned, but Dr. Johnson and Mrs. Johnson had put their 3 sons through school already, and now they were faced with putting Lavina and her sister through college, and this had obviously been weighing heavily on Lavina. She cared so much about others, and she didn't want money to be tight for her parents. This shows so much depth and awareness for someone her age. I can't say that I was that clued in or concerned to my parents' financial situation at that age.
I wonder if she was really just simply intuitive enough to understand kind of the weight of these financial pressures that were playing at her house. Like I doubt it was a topic of conversation. It's probably one of those things like Reagan can know, you know, when I'm feeling stressed, my little one can know. And she'll say like, is it work? Are you struggling? So it's funny what words we don't have to use as parents, and our kids can feel the magnitude of decisions in the household that are coming. She really strikes me as somebody who is always going to focus on the collective. So she would be watching the impact that different decisions had on people in her house. And so for this, it would be her family, right? The financial stressors. This would be way more important than her own needs. So this is remarkable, to say the least, that she's already so young. She's saying, I'm not going to be this perceived burden on the family's financials.
I mean, I get it. That's part of why I went the route that I did, is college is ridiculously expensive. And knowing that I could go to a military academy where there was no dollar tuition, you paid back with years of service, that was a big thing. And, you know, Lavina wasn't planning on going to university anywhere near her hometown of Florissant, Missouri. She wanted to broaden her horizons. She wanted to attend college in the Golden State of California. So she planned to leave Missouri winters behind, go in search of sun, sand, surf, and a great education. All the things that a college student wants to enjoy during their college years. So
I will say, though, what a brave college student, because right? I remember how hard it was that I still vividly remember when my parents dropped me off at college 6 hours away from home. Do you know where like my dad had to put his glasses on, like his sunglasses on, and he like patted me by and ran. He's a Marine, you know, so like you can't see me cry. So he like high five on the back, and then he was like sobbing on his way to the car.
Oh, I
watched him from my dorm room, you know, and I'm going, please don't leave. So at 18, I was not the adventurer and the explorer that I am now. And so I love that her plan is to say goodbye to her home, and she's going to travel halfway across the country, really, to be out on the West Coast in California. The girl is just brave.
And who doesn't want to go to California? Like, it's beautiful. Right? It's warm. And I mean, you don't have to deal with those cold winters that you do in Missouri. I'm from Canada originally, so I know about cold winters. And if you have the opportunity to live somewhere warm all year round, like granted, it does get cool in California at times, but it's never cold.
Not Canada cold.
No, not Canada cold. So forever the strategist, Lavina had been going through game plans in her head of how she could accomplish her dream education in California. And that was right around the time that military recruiters came to her school. So Lavina had an idea. And when Lavina had an idea, she could be really stubborn. This was a young woman who knew what she wanted. And when she wanted something, she stuck to her guns.
Well, Jules and Mel, I hate to break it to you, but I know quite a few people who are just like that. Me, all 20 versions of me. When you tell me like you can't, right, that this isn't going to be possible, or Ash, that's going to be a struggle, or, you know, a lot of people don't make it. That is exactly like saying, like, you're forcing me to show you that I can do it. And that not only can I do it,
okay, but hold my beer. Watch me.
Yeah. Take my earrings out right here.
I get it. It's why I'm where I am now.
So when Lavina approached her father, Dr. Johnson, with the idea to join the military, because she obviously wanted to take the financial pressure off of him and her mother, Mrs. Johnson, he knew that Lavina had already made up her mind. So Dr. Johnson himself hadn't exactly enjoyed his time as an enlisted man. So I would be remiss if I said he was excited for Lavina to follow in his footsteps with regards to something as large and impactful as military life.
I think in general terms, as a parent, like, my main goal is just to shield my child from the struggles and discomforts or challenges that I faced, right? And so I fail in a lot of areas, but it's like I'm hypersensitive to the things that I wish I had had as a kid, or that I needed from my younger self, or whatever is happening. And so for her dad, I can only imagine this worry and fear, but this simultaneous pride and admiration for her decision to want to go and join the military. I remember my dad was a Marine in Vietnam. He was shot 5 times, so he almost lost his life in Vietnam. But I remember he would always say, listen, don't do what I did. If you're going to join the military, do not be a Marine. Do it the easy way and be in the Navy or the Air Force. And it was like this joke in our family. Do you know what I mean? And he has so much respect for all branches of the military. But it was this joke because, in all seriousness,
he's not wrong.
If we were going to follow in his footsteps,
he's not wrong.
Don't do the grunt work. Like, don't be at the bottom of the totem pole. So it was always our running joke. But I know that had any of us wanted to pursue the service, it would have been the proudest moment of his life as well as the deepest, scariest moment of his life, too.
For sure. I mean, the Johnsons knew Lavina had made up her mind. She was standing firm in her decision. She knew what she wanted. And like you said, it's something that her parents admired about their daughter. However, the Johnsons also found it incredibly infuriating, and I agree with them, that the recruiters had gone to the high school and basically sold their daughter a pipe dream, a dream that could never live up to the lofty promises, like never deploying or not deploying right away, or whatever it was that this recruiter said to her. Dr. Johnson thought the recruiters filled the heads of the recruits with unrealistic expectations, and he's exactly right. These young people were filled with the desire to accomplish something important, travel the globe. So they were vulnerable. They believed the sales pitch, and none of the real issues or challenges or concerns that should have been discussed with them were brought to the surface. So these recruits would be able to figure out whether or not this was the best option for themselves in a meaningful conversation, in a meaningful way.
Yeah. And that's what you guys, when you said that they pitched that you're never going to go actually serve in a war, you don't know that. There's no way to predict that because, you know, right before September 11th, right on September 10th, no member of the military thought that anything was going to happen. And then on September 11th, right, we have one of the most catastrophic, horrific moments of our, you know, nation's history. And then the whole military landscape changed in a, 30-minute time span. So there's just no way to predict that. And so what it's almost like every other organization, I mean, military is not exclusive to this, right? When they're hiring or when I'm doing an academic job interview, it's like you're standing in front of the great and powerful Oz, right? Pay no attention the man behind the curtain, right? Don't look at all the things that could go wrong, because you can't talk about the military and all of its greatness and all of the honor that it brings and not acknowledge the issues of sexual abuse, harassment, dangers for all incoming soldiers, male and female. Particularly when you talk about women, you know that none of that is mentioned. And so there's this idea of that this is almost a passport to travel the world and to be a brave contributing member of society. And that's where the conversation stopped.
That's such an unfortunate thing too, because if people are actually sold the reality of it, would anybody really sign up? But I think that's it. They're like, we're in the business of marketing, right? We're going to market all of these good aspects. But when it comes to talking about the realities and all the pitfalls, all the sexual assaults, what you actually face if you're in combat or you're overseas, the detriment to your mental health, your physical health, those things aren't discussed. It's just like, here, you get to travel, smile, look at all these good-looking people in the poster.
And I'll propose something in kind of a devil's advocate position to that, Jules, because when I was a junior in high school, I met with my guidance counselor. She said, I think you should consider a military academy because with your academics, your demeanor, I think it would be a good fit for you. And I just kind of looked at her like, yeah, okay, sure. But after I thought about it for a minute, I was like, okay, maybe. So I started applying to the Naval Academy. I also ended up applying to the Air Force Academy. I got into Air Force. And when I told that same guidance counselor, she's like, I really think you should reconsider. And I was like, hold up, what do you mean? She's like, the Air Force Academy just had a huge sexual assault scandal last year. I was like, okay. And so I kind of knew that I still went, but that was the only conversation in a year and a half of applications, of meetings, of interviews, anything like that, that had to do with the military academies. That was the only time I had ever heard anything about sexual assault being a problem. Mm-hmm. I didn't take that advice. I still went.
As a kid too, though, you think like that happens, but it doesn't happen to me. And so I think that's a bigger deal than just, is this a military decision? Yes or no?
Right.
I remember watching the Hunting Ground documentary. And one of the things that I with my students and I watched that, I would remind them, like, listen to what this says. It says, if we told parents that your kid has a 1 in 4 chance, a 1 in 3 chance of getting raped when they come to this institution. Like, we can't tell the truth of what happens, right?
Yeah.
And even statistics don't tell the truth of what happens. So I always feel like, especially the younger you are, the more vulnerable you are to that. Like, even if I knew, I wouldn't, you know,
yeah.
I wouldn't believe it because that happens to other people.
Agreed. I didn't.
Yeah.
I was like, well, okay, that happened, but that was last year. They're going to fix it, obviously.
Yeah.
They're going to make sure this isn't a problem and I'm not going to have to worry about it.
Yeah, you think it happened last year. So what is
incredibly naive of me.
Yeah,
you think it's a very serious issue still.
You think the probability is low. Why would it happen to me? They've obviously investigated it. They've addressed these issues. They're wanting to move on in some kind of meaningful way and do better.
Right.
So when I go there, it's going to be a different experience for me.
Mm-hmm. And that's why victims blame themselves so much, because our mentality is that it wouldn't happen to me. I'm smarter. I articulate what I want. I'm strong. I can do all of these things. And so then if you are victimized, right, and you are hurt by somebody, it's that internal dialogue of like, well, maybe I'm now a lesser being because I thought I was better than that. And it's, you just can't prevent when someone wants to hurt you.
Right.
So just because Lavina was stubborn, that wasn't to say that Dr. and Mrs. Johnson didn't try to dissuade their daughter. The Johnsons did everything that they could to convince her that she could go straight into university if she wanted to. They would pay for it like they'd already arranged. But Dr. Johnson had assured Lavina that he'd prepared for his children to go to college. Like, he'd put money away and he didn't even mind if he had to go and work a couple extra years. It was totally worth it for him to see his children get an education and better themselves. But Lavina brought up to her father that she really had her heart set on going to university in California. And it isn't, for those of you who are unfamiliar, it's especially for, you know, me being a Canadian, I wasn't really aware of how costs are structured with universities, but it's much more expensive to go out of state to university. And if the Johnsons were already thinking, okay, we're going to pay for school for our children to go in state, it would have been a lot less expensive. So I can totally understand why Lavina was like, okay, I want to go and this is what I'm going to do in order for me to do it. Ashley, you went in Florida. You're from mm-hmm. Florida. And Mel, mm-hmm. where did you go?
I grew up in Pennsylvania mm-hmm. and my school, Air Force Academy, is in Colorado. But again, the cost of tuition is a service commitment after you graduate. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. there were no student loans or anything like that. So that situation doesn't exactly apply. But my backup school was Penn State University because it was an in-state school.
And how does that work with military academies? Do you basically give 4 years? Like you, mm-hmm. you do your 4 years and then you yep. give 4 years?
It's a 4-year college. So you earn mm-hmm. a degree and you do your military training and all that. And then if you graduate and are commissioned as an officer, then at a minimum from a military academy, you owe a 5-year commitment. If you are a pilot, if you are able to get a pilot slot, then I believe it's 10 years. So it's
wow.
It's a good chunk of time because, I mean, they spend so much time training you, especially if you're a pilot. You have to go through so much training to be a pilot. They want to make sure that you're going to stick around and do your service to the military before you get out and go the commercial sector.
What if you go and get a master's or PhD? Do you then owe extra time?
It depends. I didn't do any graduate studies while I was in. I just did my 5 years and got out and did my master's after I got out because mm-hmm. Air Force doesn't offer mm-hmm. master's programs in acting. I know. Shocking, right? But I do know people who have gone and become registered nurses and mm-hmm. doctors, and they do owe additional time on top of their initial commitment because of that extra education. I just don't know how much it is, but there is a definite additional commitment.
That makes sense. I've always wondered that because I'm like, I knew yeah. that you basically had to pay back like 4 or 5 years, but I always wondered right. if you yeah. go back and get additional degrees, do you then owe more time? And
yeah,
then,
right.
Like,
yeah.
so if you're a pilot and you've gone back and got a PhD, could you then be owing like 15 or 20 years? Like that's so much time.
Yeah. Don't do it.
That's so much time to just sign away. I couldn't do it.
It's crazy. And then like, when you think about just education in general, so, you know, even in state, right. Education in general is ridiculous. It is so uh-huh. expensive. Yep. I just left a private university that I was a professor at. Our school was $60,000 a year, $60,000. And it was private, but it didn't matter whether you were in state or out of state. So my social scientists were spending $240,000 to go to an esteemed school. And then guess what? When they graduate, they're making $42,000, right? A year. And it's like, it's crazy. So much of our institutions and education here, like I taught at the Citadel, I taught at TCU, like all of these places, a lot of it's legacy needs, like wanting to say I went to the same school as my parents or having this, you know, the ring from the Citadel and all of these things. And so when you then talk about going out of state, let's say not a private school, our institutions are anywhere from 2 to 5 times more costly for an out-of-state student to come. So if it's 3,000, 10,000, right, for an in-state student, you're looking at 50,000 for an out-of-state student. So it's like people can't afford this if their families aren't incredibly privileged. And so a lot of times the compromise is that I have to find an alternative means. My career is never going to pay me to pay off these student loans. So the military has been a blessing for people to leave abusive homes, to get into college. It's always been a route like that because it's permission to have a life you cannot have with your family's means.
Yeah, I think that's a great point to bring up too, because not everybody has access and student loans are crippling, right? Like people they finish their degrees. Like my cousin, she went to Harvard pre-med, Yale med. Her husband went to, I think, Harvard pre-law, Harvard law. And by the time the two of them were finished, I think they had well over $1 million in student mm-hmm. loans and she was on partial scholarships. But can you imagine you get out of school and it's like, yes, you're both going to have profitable careers. One will be a doctor, one will be a lawyer. But how long does it take to pay off $1 million in student loans?
But what about our social workers, our elementary educators? Like they're not going to have those kind of careers. No. Like my students are social scientists. They're going to be police officers or probation officers. And I'm like, babies, Good luck. Good luck.
You're almost better to go to a technical school, become a plumber. Yes.
I've talked to a lot of students about that, where I say, you know, I think there's so much pressure now that, you know, we're told you have to be at school, but you don't have to be at a traditional university. There's many options that, but families, I think it's a status thing and it's a respect thing. And they're scared their kids are going to not be respected in these technical careers that are better paying than a lot of the other ones.
Yeah. Go be an electrician. You're going to make way more money than anybody with a 4-year degree. Yeah.
But as it turns out, Lavina had been seduced by the big promises of Army recruiters. And it's easy. We've talked about this. It's so easy to be convinced by the clean, organized, glowing pamphlets, the good-looking people telling you what you're going to be doing is a job that matters. You're going to get to see the world. And the military is also going to pay for your education. A lot of people get pulled in by those promises.
And that was obviously a big draw for you, right, Mel?
Absolutely. I mean, if I hadn't gone into the academy, I would have gone to Penn State. Not that that's a horrible school by any stretch of the means, but I also wanted out. I grew up in a very small town. I still visit because that's where all my family is, but I can't see myself living there. I couldn't see myself making a life there. So the acceptance into a military school, a military academy, was my ticket out. So absolutely, I was glossy-eyed over all the promises and being able to go and do things. And I did. I went and saw a lot of cool places, met some really amazing people. And my undergraduate degree, it was paid for. So it's not a total lie what they're selling. It's just not the whole truth, where we get into dark water there a little bit.
And I think there's pressure too. Like if your parents served in the military, right? There's this really big source of pride and excitement to kind of mirror the honor that your family already has there. You know, like great grandfather was in this war and we were in this and, you know, we served our country. And when I taught at the Citadel in Charleston, South Carolina, like I told you about, my students, many of them were not there pursuing their degree. They were pursuing the ring at the end of their program because that was something that great grandfather had that, you know, my women that were in there were some of the first women that are going through this university. And so when you look at the fact that Lavina was from this military family, I'm sure a lot of it too was this legacy, honor, respect, this idea that there's patriotism and valor that runs really deep for her. She probably admired her father very much and thought, I'm going to be like him. And, you know, like as a parent, part of you goes, wow, what an honor. And the other part goes, no, run. Don't be like me.
Yeah. And it definitely sounds like Dr. Johnson felt that way. He was proud of her, but definitely didn't want her to have to walk that same path. And the idea of a free education was just so incredibly appealing for Lavina. She was petite. She only stood at 5'1" tall, but she was fit, strong, determined. She sounded feisty, and I love it. She had a strength of mind and character that would make her a force to be reckoned with, not only in basic training, because you need to be able to hold your own in basic training, but also if she was ever to be deployed and see combat. She had an unparalleled focus ever since she was a small child. Quitting was just not an option for her.
So your description of Lavina in spirit and stature reminds me of one of my dearest friends in the world, Katie Easterly Mild. She is the most gorgeous petite little thing. And holy hell, watch out world when this girl steps on any stage that she goes onto. She is physically and mentally incredibly strong. And I remember being in high school and she was going to pursue this education at Notre Dame. And she worked really hard to become a drum major of their band. And she signed up for ROTC so that they would help her with a big scholarship. And so this was a way not only where she said, I'm going to get to serve the military like my dad did, but I'm also going to get this incredible education. And I'm telling you, if you watch her walk down the hallway, you'd be like, what a cute little thing. And she turns around and you're like, do not mess with her, because she could take on the world in any like intelligence, physicality, anything. She's a badass. She's a brilliant woman. And Lavina sounds a lot like her.
So Lavina was convinced that she could serve her country just like her father had done before her. And that she knew basically because of her smarts, because of her physicality, she could keep up with the boys. She knew the basic training or boot camp wasn't going to be a walk in the park. Her father and other family members had prepared her for the mentally and physically grueling time. And Dr. Johnson knew his daughter was obviously very capable. This wasn't his primary concern. He'd served himself, and he knew that service, and especially combat, could really change people. And not only that, combat situations could bring out the very worst in the human condition. And I think it was for that reason that Dr. Johnson feared for his daughter. He knew that there was a systemic problem with sexual assault and sexism in the military, and he hated the idea of his own daughter choosing to expose herself to such a culture. He wanted so badly to protect Lavina, like any good parent would. But Dr. Johnson knew that she was of the age to make her own decisions, and all he could really do was just stand by and support his daughter, like any loving parent would do.
The military, to me, is like an organization like any other that's centered on this idea of power. And it's built on this premise of building, you know, breaking you down and then having to build you back up. And it's this idea of this pursuit of power and rank and esteem and these kinds of things. So while that is incredibly effective and has a definite purpose, I think this hierarchy and demeanor creates a space where abuses happen. And it's a place where rank creates things like secrecy, fear, silence, really scary circumstances. And we know what happens with those types of circumstances, whether you're in the military, school, gymnastics, like no matter where you are. And this is similar to like law enforcement, because I, as a criminologist, I work a lot with law enforcement and have worked in law enforcement. And I believe there's a group of fellow officers who are going to always respect and support, if not fully, you know, like go out on a limb to make sure that the women around them are safe and they adore the women in their field. However, I also know that there's a group of men who detest the idea of a female being alongside them. I've seen it firsthand, right? Whether it's because they're weaker or they're given, quote, special treatment, or they're a liability to me, or maybe because it's this history of it being a man's place, like top secret at a football game. So not top secret. When I worked at the Citadel, men were wearing shirts that said save the males, and it had a no with the woman's ponytail, you know, through it. And women were allowed in the 90s at the Citadel. And I was there from the 2011 to 2013. And they had things that said save the males. So I'm going, okay, so these attitudes create an automatic hostile environment and a place where abuse is not only possible, but it's going to be likely, because women make up 20% of our military and 63% of the assaults that happen within it, right? So I remember this New York Times article that stands out to me, and I talk about to it with my students a lot, that 1 in 16 military women reported being physically groped or assaulted in a given year, but they really estimate that like 1 in 3 or 1 in 4 are actually assaulted, same as any other civilian, right? That the military, this place you're supposed to be safe, is no better than the college you walk into, the street you walk down, nothing else, right? The place you're supposed to be serving and protecting your country is open to all these risks. And I think a lot of it goes to the way it's organized, right?
I agree. I'm sure we'll get into it a little bit later too, but going into the military thinking that they're going to have your back, that you're going to have theirs, everybody's on the same team, and it can be a very lonely place when that feeling is not there and not withheld up to the standard that you think it should be. And it's very distressing to find yourself in that situation. I absolutely felt like that.
And being a woman, you don't want to be labeled like a quote unquote troublemaker, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. You don't want to be seen as weaker. You don't want to be seen as a problem or someone who's causing a problem. Or I can remember the question/reason why a lot of women at the academy wouldn't speak up about their assaults, and myself included. It's, why would you want to ruin someone else's career? Why would you want to turn on your brothers and your sisters? Why would you want to ruin this?
And then Mel, your heart had to be saying, why would you want a man or woman like that standing next to you and serving our country? Like you would default think like, get them out of here so that good people.
You would think, but it
doesn't work like that.
It's not the way it works, unfortunately.
I am sorry that you had to experience that.
I mean, I appreciate that, but like there's so many, and not just women. There's so many people in the military men and women who have been mistreated, hazed, harassed, assaulted, raped, murdered.
Mm-hmm.
It is inexcusable for an organization that is meant to be the best and the brightest, the ones who protect us, the ones who are our first line of defense in this country. It's inexcusable. And it's really heartbreaking.
And do you think, Mel, that the statistics even close to reflect the amount of sexual assaults that happen within the military?
Absolutely not. They are so low compared to the actual numbers.
It's the same on college campuses, right? Where they talk about, we've only had two assaults last year. And I'm like, I served 23 people. Do you know, like, what are you talking about? You know, as an advocate, like, I helped 23 kids. So if I'm one of many. So when I look at the numbers, I'm going, what happens is when you talk to someone about the realities, which happens, right? That if you proceed with this report, here's the reality of what's going to happen. You scare survivors into keeping their mouth shut. And we protect the offenders, right? And that's what happens. So even when someone even comes to the point where they're having to make those kinds of decisions, people, quote, inform them of the process. And many people figure it's easier and safer for me to keep my mouth shut. And within that, survivor suffers in silence and the offender continues to perpetrate, because most offenders are repeat offenders. So like, I hate when people say like, oh, well, what do you think? All men are bad, or all, you know, women are like, I go, no, there's a very small number of serial offenders who have gotten away with it. And every time they get away with it, they become more and more brazen, where it's their right to get to hurt somebody else.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Why would they stop? Mm-hmm. Like, oh, I've gotten away with it three times already. Why would I stop now?
Mm-hmm. They become emboldened, right? And they think that this is a culture of protecting me. This is my, you know, male right to do this. And for whatever reason, the patriarchy within this institution is choosing to protect me over hearing the voice of the victim. And they're thereby silencing the victim by showing them the quote unquote process, by saying, oh, you know, everything is going to be put out there. Your name will be out there. Mm-hmm. This is a student athlete, for example, right? Like the Stanford scandal with the swimmer. And it's like, okay, this is a victim who's suffered so much, but you care more about your school winning swim meets than you do about the victims of sexual assault.
Whatever it was, 20 minutes of a bad decision or something.
Good time.
Like that to justify what he did. Mm-hmm. Don't derail his entire future because of 20 minutes. I'm like, a lot can happen in 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. Clearly.
And what's crazy is that, like, as white women, as bad as it is for white women to come forward and report, women of color and men to come forward and report, there's so many more hurdles for them. So you hear our stories, you hear Caucasian women tell of struggles, because there's actually some kind of privilege in that. And that sounds crazy, but like, there's a lot of people who are silenced, that like men can't tell their story in the military, because then there's all the homophobic things that come with that and the questioning sexuality. And then women of color, they're, you know, like, they have all these other pressures they're battling. So it's crazy.
Absolutely. Yeah. The whole situation just sickens me, and just all the more important to talk about Lavina and talk about what happened to her, because she was a woman of color, and what happened to her is a glaring, blatant cover-up, especially when you look at the evidence, just her physical evidence, her body. I don't want to jump ahead.
So as far as the recruiting process, the recruiters managed to assuage the Johnsons' fears somewhat. Obviously, they would have been far happier if their daughter was enlisted and was kept stateside, as was promised. Then they could just keep closer tabs on her, like every family wants to do. But the idea of her being an ocean away somewhere like Afghanistan or Iraq was unthinkable. This was a really close-knit family, with the two daughters being the babies of the family and then two protective older brothers. It was difficult for everyone in the Johnson family, knowing that there was a possibility that Lavina would complete boot camp and be deployed to active duty overseas.
I can't even imagine. I just can see all these guys like rallying around the table, like, what are we going to do, guys? What are we going to do? And their dad being like, you got to let her go. Like, you just got to let her go. And we pray that she comes home safely.
Yeah. I mean, because at least boot camp is stateside. It is mentally, physically, emotionally exhausting like you said earlier, the whole point is to break you down and then build you back up. That's what it does. And I didn't go through Army enlisted boot camp. My brother did. And from what he, it's tough. It's not for the faint of heart. You have to be a very tough and strong-minded person to get through it. And the fact that Lavina did that is amazing. And then again, to just assume that and believe the recruiter that she wouldn't be deployed overseas. This was early 2000s after 9/11. There was no way in hell, sorry, that a deployment was a definite no. There's no way you could say that. So I don't know who that recruiter was, but we're looking for you. You cannot say that to somebody who is vulnerable and looking for a way out and trying to do the right thing with their life. That it's just so egregiously wrong.
We see this all the time though, right? With like situations with prosecutors where it becomes not about justice, it becomes about numbers. And it feels like what this recruiter is doing is going, okay, I've got this quota of how many kids I need to enlist. And I'm more worried about me meeting this quota this month than I am about actually accurately representing the facts here. I'm going to sell this dream. And if they're willing to buy it, then okay, it's just another name I can check off and I get my numbers.
No, that's pretty accurate. I don't remember exactly how it went down. I was already at the academy when my brother was recruited for the Army, but I seem to remember there was some back and forth with the recruiter. I can't remember exactly what it was, but it wasn't a definite yes deal kind of. There was something that felt kind of sketchy from what I can remember, but this was almost 20 years ago, so my memory might be fading a bit. But like my parents, Dr. Johnson had so many reservations about this, but he knew that Lavina's whole life, she'd been told like father, like daughter, their similarities started with their looks, but it didn't end there. They seemed to share the same kind of demeanor, the same kind of drive. So he wasn't exactly surprised that Lavina wanted to take a less traditional route, much like he had done himself. But this also frustrated him because, like we've talked about, he wanted to shield his daughter. He didn't want her to have to face all the issues that he knew came with signing up and going into the military. They had prepared their whole life financially so that their children would never have to do something like this. They would never have to sign up and join the military in order to pay for a college education.
And like I mentioned earlier, Dr. Johnson was willing to make big sacrifices for his children. He was willing to like take a later retirement and work several more years if that meant that his baby would be stateside, where he and Mrs. Johnson could obviously keep closer tabs on Lavina. But his pleas fell on deaf ears, as she'd already made up her mind, and the Johnsons just had to make peace with her decision at this point. Their little baby girl was growing up, and she was gaining independence. They were super proud of Lavina, but that intrusive and persistent feeling of worry hung heavily in the Johnson home.
It's really ironic as a parent. Like, as a mom, I feel such deep, I sense things with Reagan. So she doesn't have to even communicate with me, right? That something's wrong or something's off or she's struggling with something. I can feel it. And what's even crazier is that my mom has made phone calls to me like early in the morning and been like, I didn't sleep last night because I felt something was wrong. Were you crying or were you struggling last night? And I would be like, holy heck. Like, is my mom a psychic? Because it was like, she would wake up with the feeling. And now that I'm a mom, I know exactly what she's talking about. And so it's that balancing these innate feelings of worry and dread and fear with this knowing need to let your kid kind of go out and explore and create, you know, their own world and make mistakes and fail and struggle. I mean, like, you know that that's a part of growing up. And so it's that balance I know that the Johnsons were struggling with at the same time.
So after graduation, Lavina quickly got her things together. And before her parents knew it, she was shipping off to basic training at Fort Hood. The Johnson said goodbye to Lavina. She went to boot camp. They knew this would be a huge test of her mind and body, but they were super confident in her abilities. They knew that she would be successful at whatever she put her mind to.
As a quick sidebar, we can't simply gloss over the fact that Lavina went to Fort Hood, because I know that every single one of you listening had your ears perk up when you heard that. Mel, can you explain some of the strange happenings at Fort Hood that have come out in the last year or so, including the case of Vanessa Guillen? I'm deferring to you because I think you can give some unique context and perspective on this.
Sure. And I will even go further back than Vanessa Guillen, because this is tragedy is nothing new to Fort Hood, unfortunately. From 2008 to 2011, when I was in the Air Force, I was stationed at Goodfellow Air Force Base. It's not that far from Fort Hood. I don't think at the time I was there, a lot of people outside of the military knew or were that familiar with Fort Hood. And even up until last year, I don't think they were. So if you watch the news at all during 2020, we were all at home a lot, probably watching the news, getting updates on the pandemic, things like that. But there was also a report out of Fort Hood about a soldier named Vanessa Guillen who had disappeared. And like I alluded to, there's also been several previous tragedies at the base, including two mass shootings. Probably the most well-known one occurred in November 2009. So this is when I was in Texas and we watched this unfold on the big television in our waiting area of the office that I worked in, because it was like 3 hours away. I think it wasn't that far, but like this was something that was happening in real time to our brothers and sisters in arms. And this is when Major Nadal Hassan gunned down 13 people and injured, I think, at least 30 others in a span of 10 minutes. He just went through and it shook a lot of us up. And so people hear about the mass shootings, they hear about the soldiers disappearing, they hear about murders like Vanessa Guillen, and they think, what's wrong with Fort Hood? And it's not that there's something wrong with Fort Hood. It's not like it's cursed or something like that. The issue is that Fort Hood is massive. It is the third largest military installation in the world. So with that, you have a very large population. So while it seems like Fort Hood is constantly in the news for this or that, we have to keep in mind that the size and quantity of people who live and work on this base is essentially like a small city. So with that comes a comparable level of crime. So we have to keep that in mind too. But with Vanessa's case, I think a lot of the reason why it got the attention it did, at least at the beginning, was because of her family and their tenacity. They knew that something was wrong. They knew that the Army wasn't being as forthcoming with information as we would hope when one of our own goes missing. There's a phrase in the military that they like to use that I heard a few times during my career, and it's shut up and color, which is basically just shut your mouth and do your job. And unfortunately, this can also at times spread to the civilian families of military members, especially in a situation like this where the outcome could potentially make the military look bad. And in this case, Vanessa's family wasn't about to take this shut up and color attitude sitting down. They knew something wasn't right. They weren't able to get a hold of her, I think just within a few hours of her going missing last year on April 22nd. So they started searching for her. They tried to bring their concerns to base leadership, but the Army simply basically kind of threw up their arms and said, well, we don't know where she is, which I'm sorry, that doesn't fly in the military. Accountability is a huge thing. You know where your troops are. You know where your people are. There are protocols. There are rules and regulations for this. So why were they not as concerned as they should have been when one of their soldiers was clearly missing? And like I said, I was Air Force. I don't know Army protocol. I don't know what resources are available when a service member goes missing, but it always feels like more could and should have been done. So faced with this, Vanessa's family stepped up. They held protests outside of the gate at Fort Hood. They wanted answers. They wanted attention to be shown on the fact that Vanessa was missing. And eventually this got the media involved too. But once it hit social media, I don't know if you guys remember, but it was everywhere. The case went national. You couldn't turn on the news. You couldn't look at your phone. You couldn't look on Facebook without seeing some kind of update or story or article about Vanessa Guillen. And what's also concerning and is something that I covered in a mini-sode, a Patreon mini-sode for my show last year, was that just in 2020 alone, a suspected 10 Fort Hood soldiers had been murdered or reported missing, and approximately 15 to 20 others had committed suicide or died as a result of some kind of accident. So if you were following Vanessa Guillen's story, it's very possible that you would have heard about another soldier who had gone missing named Gregory Morales. He vanished in August 2019, just seemingly up and disappeared without a trace. And like with Vanessa's case, it didn't seem like the Army was that concerned about where he was or really doing anything to look for him or help his family. They just believed that he went AWOL. He went absent without leave, and then they eventually classified him as a deserter. And people do that. I'm not saying that people don't, but there are events leading up to his disappearance that even if his disappearance had been voluntary, it just didn't seem to make sense or match this deserter theory. He was very short on his time in the military. He was within weeks of permanently getting out. He had just purchased a new car the week before he disappeared. So how does it make any sense that he would just go AWOL, up and leave his life, leave his brand new car? I know when I bought my car, you couldn't have torn me away from that thing. That was mine. I paid for it. So it was going where I went. So it just doesn't make sense. And like with Vanessa, their remains were actually found very close in time together. I believe they were both found in June 2020. They found him while they were looking for her. And it was concluded that Gregory was also murdered, just like Vanessa had been murdered. And his death certificate is still listing his cause of death as pending as of June this year. So it's apparently still under investigation. Not sure why. And once they found Vanessa's remains, it was concluded very shortly after that she had been murdered by another soldier in an arms room at Fort Hood on April 22nd, 2020, the same day that her family reported her missing. This soldier put her body in a box. He transported her off base and then mutilated and disposed of her body. And I'm not going to go into the details of that, but it is really gruesome. Both of these cases are so heartbreaking and so infuriating. And I take it very personally because I am a veteran. I was in the military. Like, these are still my people, even though I'm not in. And there's still a lot more going on with both these cases. So if anyone listening wants to learn more, I would definitely encourage you to check out the Military Murder podcast. Margot does an incredible job at covering Vanessa's case. She goes in on a deep dive. She does it in 4 episodes. And also had a chance to speak to a very prominent lawyer in the community who discusses the changes that Vanessa's family is hoping will come as a result of this situation. But yeah, things like this should not happen in the military. Cover-ups like this, lack of initiative, things like that should not happen. You're supposed to protect your own. You should protect your own. And as we're finding out more and more, that doesn't seem to be the case and hasn't been for a while.
It feels like in all of these cases, it's that people should be protecting their own and protecting the brand they represent. And instead, yes, they're trying to protect themselves and their professional position, where it's like, I can't imagine anything more horrific. Making this brave, bold decision to step up and serve your country and say that we're going to fight the bad guys, right? The people out there, we're going to protect you from the bad guys. And then you find out that these horrors that you would think might happen on a battlefield, they happen in your office, in your barracks, at, you know, the mess hall, in all these facilities on the base. Like, Vanessa was in this room, right, just putting goodies away. And this man confronts her and kills her. And so the place you should be the very safest with your brothers and sisters in the military is where we're seeing these murders and suicides that are a whole nother million episodes we could do together, right? Things that need to be taken care of in that. But I will tell you, the only encouraging thing that I see that comes out of this, because we see these false promises. We're like, yes, we're making changes. And yes, we're going to fire these 3 people. And it's like, no, this is a systemic organizational problem. So if you want to start with a clean slate with no one that has ever been here before and rebuild, maybe we can fix it, like you're saying. But this is a bigger issue. The only really positive change I see is that you see these families in their darkest moment when their baby's hurting, not just advocating for people like Vanessa, but for all military members. Do you know what I mean? They're saying, make changes beyond our baby's dead now, right? Vanessa's family went beyond just find our daughter. Mm-hmm. They said, make changes where this should never have happened to her. And I don't want another family to suffer like this. So I see this with homicide survivors everywhere, where there's this strength and hope and determination that no other family will feel this. And it is the most admirable, like, I'm in awe of a family that while they're grieving, they take it a step further and they say, there has to be change and accountability. We can do better, no matter if this is the military or somewhere else, but we can do better.
Myra Guillen's been such a great voice for her sister, like the entire Guillen family. And I think it really lit a fuse or lit a spark with women in the military who'd experienced sexual assault because of the early reporting on what might have happened to Vanessa. And then you've got a bunch, you've got this like post, you know, hashtag Me Too idea where women are feeling like, okay, like that's enough. We've had enough. We're tired of seeing this happen to women. We're tired of having this happen to ourselves. Like, we call BS, like, do something about it. Come together and do something about it. Like, address this in a meaningful way, because it just felt like you brought up earlier, Mel, they just wanted to kind of sweep it under the rug. Like, we don't know where she is. You need to know where your troops are. You're responsible for them. They're at an army base. Why don't you know where she is?
So that concludes part one of our 6 main parts in the Lavina Lynn Johnson series. There will also be some expert episodes, so stay tuned for those as well. I want to thank you all for listening. I would love to hear from you all if any of you have anything to say about the case, any thoughts. You can reach out to me at riddlemethatpod@gmail.com. Or I'm really, really active on Twitter, so please follow me. I'll follow you back at Podcast Riddle. And I just wanted to let you all know, if you're unaware, I don't have a Riddle Me That Patreon, but I have a Patreon with Dr. Ashley Wellman. So at the $3 level, you get early access, ad-free episodes. At the $5 level, there's a Jules and Ashley, where either Ashley will tell me a story or I'll tell Ashley a story. And it will be conspiracy theories solved, unsolved, kind of a little bit of everything. At the $10 level, there's a Path Went Chilly mini. So we'll have Robin joining us for that. So we're really, really excited. I will link that in the show notes. So until next time, stay safe and remember, accept nothing, question everything. Music by Jobbers.